last week, long weekend. Hope everyone enjoyed that. As Miles said, we're without Phil this week, so it's just going to be Dave, Holmes and I having a bit of a natter. For those who are familiar, you'll know what the format of these is. Any comments or questions or topics you want to throw in, as Miles quite rightly said, put them in the chat, we'll pick them up, or if not, dive in, unmute, get involved. It's as much your session as it is ours. As you may know, some weeks we have more structured topics, but this week, GDPR Radio, we just have a bit of a chat about what's been in the news, what's come up in our weeks. So, as Miles quite rightly said, I'm joined today by Dave. Dave, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, everybody, and welcome. Thank you for joining us today. Hopefully, Ollie and I will be able to do some justice to these sessions with Phil missing. As both Ollie and Miles have indicated, it is your session too. So we do appreciate people being able to unmute, ask their own questions, join in with the discussions to make the most of it for themselves. It's certainly not just our show. By all means, anybody wanting to join in, please feel free to do so.
Yeah, good stuff. Rightio. First segment this week, as regular listeners all know, generally we have a look at what's been in the news. I think Dave and I were talking beforehand, just in preparation for this, and it's been pretty inescapable this week. Is the, well, there you go, Rob's beating me to the punch, the Facebook data leak. Yeah, you can't move for information about the data leak this week. So probably best to start with that, isn't it? So this came out this week. The first response from Facebook seemed to be that, well, this actually happened in 2018. It's an old incident. We're not too interested about it. We'll deal with it, but don't worry too much, which obviously a lot of us sort of thought, well, that's an interesting approach. We'll see how this plays out. I have to say, when I saw it come up, it's possibly a bit of Facebook fatigue, if anything. But honestly, I wasn't too surprised by it. It's possibly a bit of an indictment of Facebook that they're misbehaving so regularly that it's not even shocking anymore. But personally, it didn't make a huge impression on me. There are some interesting bits to pick out, but I don't know what your first impressions of it were, Dave.
Probably similar to yours in the sense that I wasn't surprised. Quite frankly, it's maybe not a good endorsement for Facebook, but I wasn't surprised. It was kind of that, like you say, kind of breach fatigue with them, or at least misbehaving fatigue with them. One thing that stood out for me, then, we'll certainly talk around some of the elements in there in a minute, is the fact that you raised that it was an incident or a matter that originally occurred in 2019. Now, what I'd like to draw on initially, and I know it's jumping around a little bit, but it's just to kind of look to another case that's happened recently, which relates to booking.com. I don't know if you've seen this one, Ollie. There's a bit of a tenuous link, but I'll get there with it.
Yeah, so no worries. I'm happy to get onto that very shortly, because that was one in the news this week that I did notice, but I think you've probably got more to say on it than I have, so I think you've dug into a little bit more. But yeah, this Facebook data leak, I mean, from what I can tell, and anyone on the call who's dug into it further, please do feel free to jump in or correct me. But from what I can tell, the essence of it is that the records relating to, I think it's about 500 million users, it's like something like 500 million, were made available publicly this week. Those details seem to have been obtained through a process of individuals scraping the data from a vulnerability in Facebook's contact syncing system. I don't claim to be an expert on this, but we were talking beforehand, weren't we, Dave? And that I personally have had this in the past where I've, you know, been syncing contacts and information, and you sort of get more than you'd expect, actually, from people you don't necessarily deal with on a regular basis. So it's possibly come out of that, but the essence of it is that, yeah, information has been scraped from that vulnerability. It's then been sold on. And from what I understand, that information has actually, or at least this is what one source seemed to say, lost its value to a point on the in the circles where this would normally be traded, this information, that someone has decided to make it publicly available. Hence why the information was obtained in 2019, but it's only really become public now.
Yeah, no, so, for sure. When just when you mentioned scraping there, Ollie, what is scraping in that sense? So we've all got an understanding. It obviously sounds like it's illegal. It sounds like it shouldn't be happening. But what is it? Have you got any knowledge on what scraping actually is?
So my understanding of it, and again, if anyone is more experienced in this, please feel free to jump in. But my understanding is that scraping is a process whereby a malevolent user is able to collect information from a page which would normally be displayed to the user. So it's not like you're hacking into anything. It's not like an SQL injection or anything like that. It's just collecting information which is made available to you, often through an automated process. So you're collecting loads of data which you probably shouldn't be displayed to you, but it is. You're not actually breaching any security controls yourself. I think the illegality of it, Dave, you mentioned, was potentially around collecting or obtaining information from the controller which you shouldn't have access to without the consent of the controller, because obviously
what kind of offence might be in there. And certainly under section 170 of the Data Protection Act 18, there is an offence for unlawfully obtaining personal data. Obtaining or disclosing personal data without the consent of the controller, which would very kind of would appear to be scraping. By the definition of scraping, it certainly sounds like you're doing something to obtain personal data or information that the controller's possibly not aware of. We all know it's an illicit act. It wouldn't be in the news if it wasn't illegal and people are saying there's been a personal data breach, etc. But it's interesting to see how these things can tie together at times, isn't it? So there's a specific offence under Section 170 of the Data Protection Act there for unlawfully obtaining or disclosing personal data without the consent of the data controller.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think what we're seeing, some good interactions on the chat here, and I think some people generally echoing what I've potentially been feeling, which is that actually it's a bit sort of more of the same from Facebook. There's a comment there about what the difference is between this and the Cambridge Analytica incident. I'll be honest, I think the difference here is that, I mean, again, anyone correct me if they feel otherwise, but Facebook seemed to be more complicit in the Cambridge Analytica incident, whereas this has gone on sort of without their knowledge. So I think that's possibly where the nuance is. What I did find interesting, actually, in all of this while I was doing some reading around it, is that when Facebook were last investigated for their misuse of data a few years back by the US FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, apparently as part of the settlement for that, they are now bound by a requirement to notify the FTC of any incidents which affect more than 500 user records within a 30-day period. And again, this seems to be the case that they've not complied with this, obviously, because they've not told anyone about it. But I thought that was quite an interesting obligation that they found themselves under. I mean, as I say, they've not told anyone. The Irish Data Protection Commissioner is indicating that they've not heard anything from them, which obviously they would be the first to know, Facebook Ireland. But I just thought it was an interesting sort of supplementary obligation that I've not really seen before. Do you have any further thoughts on that?
Yeah, specific to the US and US laws, isn't it? If it's relating to the Federal Trade Commission, I'm not quite sure what the I've not looked specifically at the FTC's requirements. I don't know what the, other than obligation to inform them, I don't know whether the FTC's got any enforcement action that they can take as a consequence of that, or what that may mean. But it's certainly interesting that they've under the settlement that they agreed to that kind of act or that kind of action, and also then from that it appears, considering we're now in 2021 and it just come out and it relates to 2019, whether they knowingly chose not to inform.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to be the case that they've knowingly chosen not to tell anybody. Because, as I said previously, their initial response seemed to be, well, we were aware of this at the time, we dealt with it, there's no need to worry, it's an old incident. I think in the last 24 hours, from what I can tell, they've now decided to start notifying users whose information was compromised, which initially they decided not to do. But it's all, we'll have to see how it plays out. It's all very interesting, but
It's certainly
not unexpected, I think, at this point.
It certainly is, and I wonder which way the regulators will go. And this is getting to the tenuous link to the booking.com.
I was about to go for that. So yeah, can
issue.
Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so the Booking.com is obviously a Dutch company. Now, they had a data breach, and as a consequence of that data breach, hackers had gained access to login credentials for employees of over 40 hotels in the United Arab Emirates. They managed to get hold of over 4,000 details of personal details of individuals, including. So the report says payment card data for 283 people and a three-card security code for at least 97. As a consequence of all of that, the Dutch supervisory authority fined Booking.com $475,000, but that fine is purely for reporting the data breach 22 days late. So 22 days following the incident, they notified the regulator, which they're saying is not in compliance with the GDPR, as we know, with the notification principle, where there's a likelihood of harm. So kind of looking at that and then tying it back to Facebook, I wonder if any of the regulators will be going to chase Facebook now for late reporting of a personal data breach and the implications of that, with that tenuous link there to Booking.com's fine for reporting 22 days after the incident.
No, definitely. I can't see it sort of not being an issue on that front. Another piece of news that I found interesting from another sort of tech giant, if you like, although possibly not on the same scale as Facebook, but then again, how many companies are on the same scale as Facebook at this point? Was Spotify, and I missed this initially earlier in the year, and it's come back. It made an appearance on my LinkedIn feed this week, but Spotify seemed to have filed a patent for a piece of technology which I thought was really interesting. So this is just at a very early stage. I don't think it exists yet. I think it's just something they're exploring as an option, but it's a piece of technology which essentially they claim will be able to analyze the voice of a user and use this to suggest, to make recommendations for music based on, and I quote, emotional state, gender, age, or even accent, which I thought was very odd. I mean, essentially amounting to profiling. This technology makes observations about the user, their environment. Apparently it can pick up on whether you're on your own or you're at a party or anything like that, and then make recommendations based on your mood. I just thought this was very odd. I mean, it's, again, possibly not surprising considering the way things are going, but the quoting of the fact that it might make suggestions based on your accent, I thought was particularly odd. I don't know if you saw this, Dave.
I found it really quite interesting from a technology point. I mean, obviously, it's got privacy implications and, like you said, potentially profiling it and putting people into categories for targeting particular kind of mood music, shall we say, and whether that could then whether there's any kind of function creep then to that technology to mean if you're in feeling in a particular emotional state, you may well be more susceptible to particular ads, not just music, and whether the whole lot can have a bit of function creep built in to that. But what was particularly interesting to me was, I think it was only a couple of weeks ago that the BBC reported on the news about tags for individuals that had have been released early from prison with the kind of the convict tag. I can't think what you call it. I don't mean to be disrespectful by calling it that, but that's the home location tag, or whatever it's called. And there was a story in the BBC News saying that could pick up on your sweat glands to determine whether you've breached your conditions by drinking alcohol or going to the pub to drink alcohol.
Yeah, I saw that, that they've now built this in, so certain offenders, because their offences are based on drinking or being drunk when they commit them, that you can have as a condition of your early release or whatever it might be, that you remain sober, and therefore the ankle tags can now detect in your sweat whether you've been drinking or not. And they reckon that it's sufficiently accurate to work out whether it is actually from drinking or, you know, maybe you've been using hand sanitizer or anything silly like that.
And Yeah, and what I found really interesting about that, and then tying it to the Spotify, was whether the ankle tag could then be further developed to kind of go, well, if we can determine people's emotional state and from a Spotify point and provide them with relevant music that may be more in tune with their emotional state, whether you could also do that for individuals that may be released from prison, not just with kind of alcohol issues, but aggression issues. If you could determine through an ankle tag that somebody's of a heightened and angered kind of emotional state, whether that would then trigger something else. It's all kind of quite, I know it's a bit sci-fi, a little bit kind of futuristic in that sense, but it kind of got my mind working back to, I don't know if anybody remembers the film Minority Report. Around about 2054, I think it was filmed, or it was meant to represent 2054, where you could pick up individuals prior to committing a crime, that kind of thing. And it made me kind of wonder whether that technology is actually maybe moving both with Spotify being able to pick up on your potentially emotional state or anything else that you mentioned there, Ollie, and likewise with these ankle tags for picking up on sweat glands and determining primarily whether you've had a drink, but whether that could then have function creep elements in there to determine potentially state of mind.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, arguably, you mentioned there that it's all a bit sci-fi, but it's less and less futuristic in sci-fi. You know, the technology is catching up to these ideas, and before long, we most likely will have something to that effect, Dave. I wouldn't be surprised if I read an article saying that that had been developed. Rick makes an interesting point and says, would the use of the tag data need to abide by Article 10 conditions, so obviously criminal conviction or offence data? I'd assume that because it's being processed by whatever body would be responsible for that, prison service maybe, I don't know, that would fulfil an Article 10 condition, because under official authority is one of the conditions. Is that right, Dave? Or am I making that up?
Yeah, no, possibly. It's certainly an interesting point that is made as to whether you'd have to... You'd certainly have... If you're picking up on whether an individual's had a drink and whether that's got indicators of health to it, whether you've got an Article 9, but whether you're processing criminal conviction data per se, or whether you're processing information that may indicate whether the individual's had a drink, and is that a necessarily a crime or conviction, as in a statutory offence, or whether it's just a breach of licence. So it's certainly an interesting concept to kind of moot around. I don't know if Rick, you've got any other thoughts on that yourself, and would like to unmute and join in by all means. But it's certainly a very interesting concept.
Yeah, it is.
David, I was just thinking just about if there was, you know, a secondary use. So if you was tying it back to, you know, the tag data goes to Spotify, for, you know, you could have a special ex-cons playlist or something. But there could be a whole bunch of, you know, additional uses that people could monetize that would need to fulfill them conditions. Because the data would be travelling across all sorts of networks, you don't know where it could be.
No, for sure. I was just when you mentioned about tying it back to Spotify, then I was trying to rack my brain rather quickly, and I failed. But to think of whether there's any kind of theme or artist or song title that I can tie back to tie back to that thing to represent it. But
should we give you a minute and we'll come back to you on that one? John raises a point in the chat. He says he's read on LinkedIn this week about the Home Office, having a very large database of the UK public, and it has been questioned about their analytical use. Has anyone read this? I have to be honest, John, I've not seen that. I don't know if you want to come on and talk about that, but it certainly sounds interesting. It's not something that I admittedly have seen. I'd be curious to know a little bit more about what they might be doing on that front.
You just on mute there, John.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yeah,
we can, yeah.
Yeah, when I read the article, it was done by very much a sort of data protection company. I can't remember the name of it, but it was saying about the volume of the size of the database and the nature of the use of the database, and questioned the intent of the use of the data. And that if somebody can probably call it up on LinkedIn, try and get it that way. It was quite a detailed article, and it was going into detail about sort of the nature intent of use of data, and that if they're really practicing what they preach.
Yeah, I see Peter and Rick have just linked it in into the chat for all those interested. So this is the Data Services and Analytics Unit, which I'll be honest is the first that I've heard of them. But we're talking about, is this right, 650 million people, including children under the age of 13? That seems like an awful lot.
Yeah.
Crikey. Well, yeah, I think you'd most certainly have to consider the intent behind all of this.
Why not? How does that compare with Facebook?
Well, exactly. Maybe there's some scope for partnership there. I wouldn't put it past them. But no, interesting that. I'll have to dig into it in greater detail.
I hadn't actually come across this. So thank you for sharing. I was just trying to have a quick look through there, Ronnie, while you and John were just kind of talking about it. The 650 million is a huge number of people, which would means either you've got a lot of information and a lot of duplicates and poor data quality going on, or you've got people outside of the UK. Is it tied to immigration? So Home Office hoarded millions of data. Is it immigration data? So you've got individuals who's coming to and from the UK possibly, but 650 million dwarfs the number of residents in the UK. So there's certainly a lot more people on there than just UK citizens.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like probably a pretty reasonable take, that it'll be tied into immigration purposes, which if we cast our minds back, actually, and we were talking about this at the time, was one of the issues which we thought maybe would affect our ability to get an adequacy decision processing of immigration data.
For sure. It says in the article, little is known about where the data come from. While the government procurement notice published in January 2020 says the unit has access to commercial databases, data from immigration and border systems, and data from police and intelligence agencies. Crikey.
Yeah, I know.
All of the specifics were redacted in the Data Privacy Impact Assessment document made available by the Home Office. Wow.
Yeah, Rick says he felt it was in line with the surveillance that Max Friends used in his case to take down Privacy Shield. And yeah, I'd have to agree. It's pretty much along those lines. No, very interesting. I saw a couple of other bits in the news this week, which I thought were quite good. The Italian regulator, which is not one which I have seen being particularly active, although I'm happy to stand corrected on that. But apparently they've recently fined a company almost 5 million euros, or 4.5 million euros, for what they term aggressive telemarketing, in inverted commas. But generally speaking, it seems to be the case that this company just had complete and utter disregard for data protection laws. They had no interest in complying and were just aggressively and unlawfully collecting information on people to spam them. One particular incident of note that I picked out is that apparently they were pressuring people to provide their ID documents over WhatsApp as part of this entire process to further continue spamming them and others, which is quite interesting. But I like the term aggressive telemarketing in place of a complete disregard of the GDPR.
Aggressive telemarketing would suggest that you could have different versions of telemarketing that's less than aggressive that might be permissible. But as we're aware, the telemarketing will be caught by things like PECA and the implications of PECA. And I think they've got some kind of common ground for negotiating on the update to the previous regulation, I think, if I've read rightfully, Ollie. I've not seen some of the details, and it's certainly not been fully approved, but it's been bounced around for many years. It originally was scheduled to come out in line with the GDPR, but the member states of Europe, including the UK, when we're party to it, I think it must be like the biggest or the most debated part of data protection law, because they still can't come to an agreement of what will be in this e-privacy regulation. So it'll be certainly interesting to see whether aggressive telemarketing makes its way into that one.
No, absolutely. I think it probably will. And actually, the one aspect of that I am quite interested in, because it's something which I've been coming across quite a lot recently, is how it will adapt to all the changes around cookies, similar technologies and the laws which affect those. Because as we've seen over recent weeks, that is a particularly fast-moving area of the law. well, not the law itself, but rather the industry and the law trying to keep up with it. So I'd be curious to see how that's going to play out.
Yeah, no, for sure. And then obviously once the privacy regulation, if it ever gets to the point of being finally approved and becoming law in Europe, what that might mean for the UK, because we're still operating PECA under the Privacy and Electronic Communication Regulations that came about to give effect to the European Directive or the Privacy Directive. So if that's now being replaced, what does that mean for the UK considering Brexit? So although we're probably not necessarily bound, will that naturally mean we're going to have to review our own e-privacy regulations to either tighten them up, make them more in line with Europe or otherwise? It'd be certainly interesting to see where that one might go as well.
No, certainly, certainly. Just reading the chat now, Rick saying that apparently Schrems is now after Google and their unstoppable Android tracking. That's hardly surprising, but we'll have to see how that plays out. Certainly interesting. The tracking aspect, again, I suppose it ties into this and how that's going to change moving forwards. On the broader remit of sort of telecom was more general, I know it's a bit of a tenuous link, but I saw quite an interesting some interesting enforcement action out of the Romanian regulator recently, where they fined a telecoms company €10,000 for inappropriate or insufficient security measures, which led to about 100,000 of their customers' records being leaked. And while the breach in and of itself isn't particularly interesting, what I did find interesting was the number of records and the level of the fine imposed on them. Because if you're talking about €10,000 fined for the breach of 100,000 customers' records, I'll let you do the maths because I can't personally. But, but no, if you're looking at, you know, 10 cents per person in terms of records breached, I think it feeds into this broader conversation, which I've definitely seen happen, particularly on LinkedIn, around, well, what is cost of privacy? How do we value that on a monetary perspective? And then sort of wider considerations around enforcement action, whether regulators are doing enough. I know we've talked at length about, you know, primarily enforcement coming from the individuals and potentially claims and damages, as we've seen, you know, the most noteworthy one being BA. But I thought it sort of fed into this conversation more broadly and, you know, where this might go. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that more broadly, Dave.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was reading something recently relating to non-material damages under the GDPR, because there was a court case, there's a German court case where they've, I think they've pushed it back to the European Court of Justice, kind of going, well, we've got this thing for the right to compensation, but what is the level, is a kind of a de minimis level at which compensation is not available, or is compensation available from the outset, that kind of sort of thing. I'm sure the German court said it's really rather unclear. And as a consequence of that, there was another relates to the Dutch, I think it was. And it's the, just trying to quickly search for it here while I'm looking for it, thinking about it. But I think the Dutch DPA had produced a blog about the right to claim non-material damages. And that's that should result in compensation from the outset. In order, so there's this kind of, and it's kind of moving around a bit because it's not been fully determined. So when looking at compensation and things under the GDPR, the right to claim compensation under the GDPR, previously there was some kind of hurdles to kind of get through from the European Court of Justice for non-material damages, in the fact that the effects must be actual and certain, for example, you can't just literally state that you suffered loss. You had to demonstrate it, that kind of thing. And this blog's quite interesting because it's starting to look at whether trivial breaches should also be compensated for. It's only a blog. It's certainly not saying that the law's changing at the moment, but it relates to the German court case that pushed the decision to the European Court of Justice to decide upon.
No, you're right. It's interesting, and I suppose it does feed into sort of these wider conversations about the claims and compensation that we're seeing. And as I'm sure many people on this call will be aware, you know, increasingly this culture, and this is often what I'm sort of driving home more than fines these days, to be honest, is the ambulance chasers. Claiming for data breaches, because it seems everywhere now.
Because, and I mean, it's a it's a bit of a two-pronged attack to answering the question regarding the Romanian regulator that you mentioned when you're talking about the value of privacy. Are you talking the value of privacy based on the regulator's fine, in which case I think you mentioned around about 10 cents per person? And is that the value of privacy because of the fine that the regulator imposed? Or are you looking at the value of privacy being linked to any compensation that you may be able to obtain or achieve should you be successful at establishing that your rights have been infringed? So then would that also be a different value of privacy? Because compensation, especially in collective class actions or group litigation orders, as we've seen, I think it was with British Airways, there was some chats within the on LinkedIn suggesting that could end up costing British Airways 80 million quid. So it's certainly interesting when we're looking at what is the value of privacy, whether we're looking at the regulatory fines or inaction. And I've certainly seen some inaction by our own regulator where you thought fines may have, or at least some kind of fine may have been input through to claim to compensation.
No, quite. And then I suppose you know, questions naturally come about over whether we're moving to an enforcement model where regulators are essentially, you know, carrying out enforcement action, which is anecdotal almost, and is just sort of signalling to the affected data subjects that that's an area where they might be able to claim compensation, they should take it up.
For sure. I mean, I find this all really, really interesting because you've got, without going off my little soapbox about it, if you look at the definition of a personal data breach, it requires you to have a breach of security. Then at Article 32, you've got the security security relating to processing security or something, isn't it? Article 32 and the elements there. And both bits around security requires you to have appropriate security that is appropriate to the risk. So there is an argument that if you've got sufficient or appropriate security in place that is appropriate to the risk and you had a personal data breach, does that necessarily then mean that your security wasn't appropriate, or does that then mean that you can actually have a breach in some cases that doesn't necessarily mean that your security wasn't appropriate in the first place? So once you then start taking those elements into account, how does that affect the claim for compensation? Because if compensation is tied to security argument, say, so that there wasn't sufficient security in place, then you could argue that a compensation is quite a valid argument, have been infringed because you've had insufficient security. But if you, as the controller, could demonstrate, well, actually, the security that we had in place was appropriate to the risk, and it's still appropriate to the risk, and deemed or held to be appropriate to the risk, does that mean that they won't be paying compensation because the security wasn't insufficient in that sense?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think it feeds into a wider conversation about what appropriate technical and organisational measures, you know, even are. I saw someone using as sort of a conversation starter recently on my network saying that if you have a personal data breach, does that mean that whatever you had in place is automatically not appropriate? Because clearly, if it were appropriate, you wouldn't have had a breach. Is that a reasonable stance? I'd argue that's potentially a bit extreme. I'm not entirely sure I agree, but it's certainly an interesting conversation around that. At what point do your security measures become appropriate?
Absolutely. I'm sure I've read something recently in relating to a communication, only through human error, an email going astray or a letter going astray, and whether security in place was sufficient. The incident happened, but I'm sure it was held in that case that actually the security in place was actually appropriate to the risk, because saying that you need appropriate security is different to saying you need absolute security. So therefore, if you've got appropriate security but not absolute, then there's still room for things to occur, but doesn't necessarily mean that what you've got in place isn't fit for purpose. So very interesting area to kind of start delving into and digging around in a bit further.
Yeah, quite. I have to apologise at this juncture because I have been keeping an eye on the chat, but not picking up on it. There's been a really interesting conversation on there about something which actually approximates something we discussed earlier this week, you and I, Dave, which is call recordings, and particularly from what I can tell, for customer service purposes or training quality and monitoring purposes. Now, we talked about this earlier because one of my clients came to me this week asking about it, and there was an obscure piece of precedent in the back of my mind that popped up, you know, that little voice that said that actually, depending on what kind of training you're doing, you might not be able to use legitimate interest. You might need consent to record calls for training purposes. Now, very helpfully, you went and found that precedent for me, Dev. I don't know whether you want to elaborate on that for us a little bit as part of this wider conversation.
Yeah, no, I certainly think it's quite an interesting point. It relates to a Norwegian case and a Norwegian supervisory authority that suggested that you, for training purposes, you can't rely on consent. Sorry, you need to rely on consent. You can't rely on legitimate interest for processing under for training purposes. And that kind of got me thinking. I'm not quite sure if it was only an interim judgment or whether it is kind of a wholeheartedly, this is the case, this is the facts, that kind of thing. But it certainly got me interested in kind of looking around the area, because my first kind of thought process when I read that was, well, what type of training are you doing? What are you recording? What type of training are you doing? In that sense, are we talking about training where you've got people learning how to be a customer service agent and you're playing back the call and all the intricacies of that call to a team of people to help them understand how to calm down an individual, how to pacify them, how to turn around an aggravated call into a positive call, for example? And although you can see some great value in that, you would have honestly thought if you're going to trot that out quite regularly, that you would potentially need the consent of the individual for doing so, because in order to protect their own rights to privacy and confidentiality, in that sense. And then if you're going to get consent, how do you get consent? Because most of the calls like that, in my eyes at least, will probably be from an aggravating factor and trying to calm somebody down. And before doing that, saying, by the way, we're recording your call and we'd like to use it for training purposes. Do you agree? Would seem like you're not going to get the answer you're looking for in that sense. So it led me to kind of think, well, what do we mean by training? Are we talking literally call monitoring, as in the team leader may listen in to a live call now and then in order to give direct feedback to the individual? Are we talking about training in the sense that, well, we've identified a particular call and we can anonymize it, so therefore we'll still use it, but in an anonymized way, so we can't tie it back to anybody? Or are we talking about actually not having any controls around it, not having any restrictions to it or safeguards to it, and literally just playing the whole lot back? Now, I think at each of those different levels and different junctures that you could potentially say, well, if you're doing it in a completely unredacted format, listening to the whole call and continually to trot that out to a range of people through a training program, yes, you will probably need consent. However, you could say that you are doing it as call monitoring. So, for example, I'm Ollie's line manager. Ollie was on a call. I would occasionally listen in to monitor how his call's doing. And you probably say, well, that's kind of that's probably more acceptable under legitimate interest, because you're not physically recalling or reusing or isolating that call for a particular use over and over again. So it certainly got me interested in that element of IVRs, when we're saying we're doing stuff, by the way, your call's being recorded for training purposes, whether you like it or not, kind of approach.
Yeah, quite, because I think the essence of it is that is basically what the client was doing, you know, playing the IVR message and basically just saying, look, you're being monitored, this call's being recorded, and we'll use it for training purposes, brackets, general. So it's interesting to see how that develops. I'm going to have to work through it with them.
Because what options would you have then if you said, well, actually, I don't want to be call recorded? Does that mean at that point the onus is on the data subject to say, when the operative picked up the phone, can you please turn off recording because I don't want to be recorded? Or have you got no option but to be recorded, in which case the only other option you have then is, well, I'm going to have to put the phone down because I don't want to be recorded in this conversation. What options have the individual got to manage their own rights around whether they want to be recorded or not?
Well, exactly. It's a complex issue. And I mean, I even had a slight variant in all this with a different client of mine, whereby, and this feeds into what you were saying about different types of training, where they were getting the brand new customer service advisors on sort of their early, you know, training. And they would literally just sit them next to an experienced customer service advisor and just listen into the call. So what do you do at that stage? You know, and they were saying, well, how do we go about doing this compliantly? You know, what do you rely on legitimate interest? Do you need consent for that? And this, by the way, was also a controller who dealt with medical data at times. So you've again got an extra complexity to it all. It's clearly a difficult issue, one which I'm going to have to try and find an answer to pretty sharpish.
No, for sure. And I think I'm just trying to look through some of the chats there as well. We're starting to get some good feedback and some good interaction this afternoon. So we've got Lars making a couple of comments there saying, where do we start? I'm just scrolling down. So if processing is a legitimate interest for quality and training, then it wouldn't be based on consent as long as I can form as soon as a call. I was saying we couldn't rely on legitimate interest for training. It's a very difficult call. I think we've covered that one with the conversation. How do you could you do legitimate interest for training? It depends what you define as training, I think. We've got through that point. By all means, Lars, if you want to unmute and join in, we're happy to have a conversation around that. You've helpfully, I think, put in the chat below in relation to the Danish data protection case and the telecommunications company underneath. So that's very helpful there.
Maybe I'm accepting your invitation to unmute myself and just barge in. So originally my question was coming because I'm looking at the moment for my company in different setups, and because we are having customers across the continent, it was quite surprising to see how incoherent the different regulators and legislations are treating this. You would think with the GDPR, there's a much more broader understanding of the same topic, but it is actually particularly the question regarding, do we need consent? Do we need a legitimate interest? Different regulators have different interpretations there. My question was, is there anywhere a resource out there which actually is listing all these different country-specific ones? Is anybody aware of that? Because I think in Britain, it's actually more clearer than in some of the other countries how you're doing it practically.
A very good point you made there, Lars, and thank you for unmuting and joining in. You're absolutely right. I would have thought, similar to yourself under the GDPR, there'd have been a bit more of a common consistency to its how it's applied. But then you've got the national legislation may well be tweaking that. There may well be bits of Norwegian law that are also then feeding into certain decisions being made, especially with the relevant Danish case there. I'm not aware of, and by all means, if anybody is, please do unmute and join in. I'm not aware of anywhere where it's documented saying, at this moment at least, in the UK, this is a measure, in Germany, this is a measure, in France, this is a measure in relation to telecommunications, training purposes, and any particular lawful basis around that, or the requirements to justify either consent or legitimate interest or otherwise. I'm not sure if have you come across anything like that, Ollie?
No, to be totally honest, I haven't found that sort of consensus drawn up anywhere, and not even necessarily if it is a consensus, just that sort of resource. It's certainly one which I think would be incredibly useful to a lot of us. But, you know, ensuring consistency or even just understanding those nuances across the continent can be incredibly tricky at times. As far as I'm aware, certain European countries don't even have equivalents to the TPS that we have. So again, that's something that you would have to bear in mind. I'm happy to stand corrected on that, by the way, but from memory, that's the case. But no, a lot of the time, I think we do get some of these issues as professionals in this industry around finding those sort of good resources, you know, those hubs of knowledge, and being able to go and find those and consult them. It can be really quite difficult.
For sure. And I think in Lars' case, where you may be doing cross borders within Europe, could get quite tricky with the different applications or the different understandings by their own or by each state's own supervisory authority.
Yeah, I've had issues with this relatively recently, because one of my clients was engaging with a Finnish supplier. And we were having conversations around what they do, and they seem to indicate they were adamant, in fact, that they didn't process any personal data through this application, which they were basically promoting to my client. And unfortunately, they were simply wrong. They were processing personal data. you know, Dave, you and I spoke about it, and we're absolutely adamant. And even though that one is possibly easier to resolve, there's always that sort of voice in the back of your mind when you're dealing with potentially suppliers on the continent, that these national laws which exist, or even different case laws, different precedents, different guidance that might exist, you know, the interpretation around that, it can be an absolute minefield to navigate.
Yeah, no, for sure. It certainly can. I don't think we were able to give Lars an answer there to any publications. I don't know if you've got part publications or anything that you can rely on there, Lars, or if there's any other question you want to come back with.
I think what I'm taking from it is whatever my findings are, I should write them together and publish them somewhere.
I think you'd be the most popular out of all of us if you did that.
But maybe just a small other technical question where I can pick your brain on. If you don't have a specific website in a country, let's say Hungary, you don't have a phone number in Hungary, but you have a customer who's phoning your British phone line, how would you filter that out, that customer is falling under more or less Hungarian data protection regulation while being completely in the UK system? So if there are different, for example, if you have a consent requirement in Hungary, but you don't have one in the UK, how would you technically filter that out to make sure that that Hungarian customer is treated in his appropriate way or her appropriate way?
I think I'll leave that one to you, Twally.
Thanks, Dave. No, I mean, technically, I'll be completely honest, I don't have a clue how you would actually enforce that. I know that we've had conversations a number of times around extraterritorial applicability, and obviously Brexit now adds an additional layer to all of this in terms of both our EU and UK GDPRs. I mean, the closest I've come to anything in that capacity is establishing, which is a process I've had to go through recently. I don't know if anyone else has had to do this, but the process of establishing European representatives for some of my UK-based clients. But no, in all honesty, I don't know, Dave, if you've got any thoughts on it, but I have no idea how you would go about that.
It's a very good question. I think I'd have to spend a little bit of time thinking about the implications of it. I think it's a question I think probably going to stump me to start with. So you're based in the UK. You got an international incoming call from within Europe, and basically, well, how does consent work, I guess? For individuals in that sense, and could you either switch it on or switch it off for particular incoming calls? Well, I'd be unless there's some technology to kind of indicate that it's an inbound external to the UK call, so kind of an international call coming in. But the difficulty would be then, I guess, being able to demonstrate whether there's particular requirements that you've got to provide to that call or not provide to that call. So for example, if we're relying on consent, you've got to demonstrate that consent's been met. How would you do that? You know what I mean? I think it's going to be something we'd need to take away and just kind of mull over for a little bit, I think, and to tease out some of the parts we in relation to the wider extraterritorial reach, I think. But certainly a very good question.
And a complex issue to boot. Yeah, very, very interesting. I'm just conscious of time because normally these sessions are scheduled to only run for 3/4 hour, 45 minutes, although we could probably go on all afternoon in all honesty. So, Dave, is there anything that you wanted to raise in particular? And then if there's anyone on the chat, which if there are any questions there still that people want to flow. I mean, we do run these sessions, the GDPR radio one specifically, every other week. So, you know, there's always another opportunity 2 weeks from now to come on and discuss any of these issues. But if there's anything in particular that anyone wants to look at this juncture, and Finn, that day, whether you have any points to look at?
Not specifically for this session. I think we picked up on the most of the bits that we're going to look through. earlier. Like I said, the main one I was interested in is the late report. Well, the two bits I was interested in was late reporting for personal data breaches by Booking.com and the fines that they've had. And then the bit, and we've had the discussion about it, about personal data breaches of security. What is security? What is adequate security? Clearly, security is an absolute. So what's the difference between the two, and where compensation sits within that? Or potentially compensation sits within that, reflecting slightly on the German case and the blog by the Norwegian data protection supervisor. So it's certainly a developing area of the law, certainly looking for some clarity, especially within the EU, with it going to the European Court of Justice. Whether that will still translate into the way the UK do things as a consequence of Brexit is also an interesting point to be mindful of as well. But those were the main points that I was looking to. I was quite interested also in the development of technology, both with the ankle bracelet, as mentioned by the BBC, and with Spotify that you mentioned. I do apologise for saying it seemed a bit all futuristic. I'm a little bit older than you, Ollie, so in my mind, I'm still only 22 myself. But 22 to me means I was going back to the 90s. So it's probably the reason why I think it's futuristic.
Don't you worry. It's just, I think, a marker of the pace that things are changing at, to be honest. It all feels still futuristic to me, don't you worry. So I think that's probably going to be it for this week, to be honest. As I say, it's probably a good point now to call a close to it, because otherwise we might be here all afternoon. Not that that's not appealing to me. So thank you, Dave. Thank you, everyone on the call, for attending. Thank you, everyone, for joining in. Some really great feedback this week. We're trying to make this a bit more interactive, because we've had some feedback over the last couple of weeks that perhaps we don't open up the floor enough. We do have a tendency to monologue and to yak on a little bit, so trying to be more interactive. I think this has been a really good session. Always good to exchange thoughts, exchange information, takes on things. So that's probably going to be it from us this week. I'll let Dave say goodbye very shortly. We'll be back next week, Miles. I'm not entirely sure with what the topic is next week, but we'll be back with a main session and then another GDPR radio.
It's actually your session next week. On the pecker, it is.
I thought it might be.
So you're back in the hot seat.
I better start preparing for that. Am I doing cookies or am I doing direct marketing next week?
Oh, now you're asking. I don't actually know. You're going to have to bear with me. I can't remember which one is next week. Next week we are doing... We're doing... I still can't see it.
Well, either way, we'll be doing the pecker next week, whether it's direct marketing or cookies.
It's cookies, and then direct. It's cookies, and then there'll be GDPR radio, and then there'll be another session of. Then it'll be your other pecker session.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to seeing you all again, hopefully next week, to talk about cookies. And until then, take care. Thanks for all attending.
Yeah, no, thanks very much for joining in, everybody. Please do get your elbows out and join in. It's really great that you can unmute and take part, make the session your own as well. It's always great to have conversations outside of just myself, Phil and Ollie. So hopefully next time you'll have encouraged more to do so. So thank you very much for those who both took part in the chat and verbally by unmuting and joining in.
Thanks,
thank you, everybody. Cheers, bye.
Thank you. Take care then. Bye-bye.